This is week 10 of our study of the prophetic portions of Revelation. This week, our focus will shift from the beast of Revelation chapters 13 and 17 to the woman who rides the beast. This is the harlot called in Revelation 17, Babylon the Great. Our biblical text will be primarily chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation. Because the harlot represents several things, including a city, we will begin our study with a look back at some of the biblically relevant history of the city of Babylon. In Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 and 7, we are told that after the flood, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." In Genesis chapter 10, we are given the genealogies of the sons of Noah, which have become known familiarly as the Table of Nations. For our purposes today, the son of Noah we are interested in is Ham. Verse 6 of chapter 10 tells us that his eldest son was named Cush. Verse 8 tells us that Cush became the father of Nimrod, and that Nimrod became a mighty one on the earth. Verse 9 says that Nimrod, quote, "was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord," close quote. We can easily misunderstand what is meant when verse 9 says that Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. This is not talking about a skilled big game hunter. To get what is meant here, we need to employ some more modern slang. The expression "before the Lord" means "in his face." It was a deliberately defiant rebellion against God right in front of his face. According to Barnes' notes, his name, Nimrod, means rebel or rebel. This was a hunter of men who went about ruthlessly conquering other people in his quest to build an empire for himself. Verses 10 through 12 set that out explicitly. That passage states, "And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel," which is properly pronounced Bebel, I learned, "and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ir and Calah and Resen between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city." Although I could not find a map that placed all of these locations, this map has enough of them to show you that the territory of Nimrod's kingdom was rather large. He built four cities in Shinar, also known as Babylonia, and he built four more cities in Assyria. We know that both Babylon and Assyria became enemies of Israel. According to Adam Clark, the name Babel or Bebel, quote, "signifies confusion, and it seems to have been a very proper name for the commencement of a kingdom that appears to have been founded in apostasy from God and to have been supported by tyranny and oppression." Continuing in Genesis chapter 11, we learn that all the people of the earth spoke the same language. Some commentators take the position that their unity of language also indicated unity of purpose. After settling in the plain of Shinar, they decided to build a city and a tower that would reach to the heavens. A more literal translation of verse 4 is "a tower whose top was unto the heavens," which indicates a worship of the sun and the moon and the stars rather than of the creator of the sun and the moon and the stars. This tower may have been a ziggurat, which was an ancient form of temple. The base could be a square or an oval or a rectangle, but then each terraced layer was built in receding tiers so that it looked similar to a pyramid. Often the top of the ziggurat carried the signs of the zodiac. Astrology is a very old false religion. Returning to Genesis chapter 11, verse 4, the plural of the Hebrew word that is translated into English as heavens indicates that more than just the first heaven, where the birds fly and the clouds form, was intended. The word also includes the second heaven, which is where the sun and the moon and the stars are. That they did not intend to include the third heaven, the celestial home of the Lord and the angelic beings, is made clear by this same verse 4 of chapter 11, which tells us that their express purpose was to defy the command of God to fill the earth and to populate the earth abundantly. They did not want to be, quote, scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Thus, they would form their own religion centered around this tower, which focused on the objects in the heavens, in an attempt to prevent their being dispersed. One commentator, Barnes, from Barnes Notes, suggested that the reason they wanted to build a tower unto the heavens was to survive another worldwide flood, should it occur. But the same verse 4 tells us of their pride. They wanted to make a name for themselves. So there were several reasons for the building of this tower, and all of them defied God. 1, they wanted to worship the stars. 2, they wanted to escape any future judgment. 3, they wanted to exalt themselves. And 4, they did not want to obey God's command to disperse and populate the whole earth. Verse 7 of Genesis chapter 11 says that in response, the Lord God confused their language so that they could not understand one another's speech. Verses 8 and 9 read, "So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth." Thus, from its very inception, the city of Babel was a center of false religion, formed in rebellion against God. In the appendix of our workbook on pages 263 to 276, there is an excerpt of a paper written by Dr. Charles H. Dyer in 1993 entitled, "The Biblical Argument for the Rebuilding of Babylon." This covers in some detail the secular history of the original Babel, later called Babylon. Dr. Dyer begins with the conflict between Babylon and Assyria during the time of Assyria's dominance in the world. Fortunately for us, this is the next time that Babylon becomes relevant from a biblical point of view. In 689 BC, the Assyrian kingdom, under the control of Sennacherib, conquered the city of Babylon and utterly destroyed it. According to Dr. Dyer's paper, the city remained in ruins for the following 8 years. Sennacherib's successor, however, spent the 12 years of his reign rebuilding the city and restoring the old temples. What is called the Neo-Babylonian Empire began with the father of Nebuchadnezzar, whose name was Nabopolassar, and he ruled from 626 to 605 BC. Nebuchadnezzar ruled from 605 BC to 562 BC. Those of you who are familiar with the book of Daniel know that Nebuchadnezzar ruled over Babylon when God used that brutal and powerful nation to conquer and to take into captivity for 70 years the southern kingdom of Judah. Daniel was taken as a young teenager to Babylon, and he lived the remainder of his life there. Although it is arguable that Nebuchadnezzar became a believer in Daniel's God toward the end of his life, it does not change the fact that the Babylonian Empire was known for its idolatry. Just as the statue of Daniel chapter 2 and the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7 foretold, the Babylonian Empire was conquered by the Persians and the Medes, and they in turn were conquered by the Greeks. Alexander the Great intended to establish Babylon as his chief city in the east, and to that end, he began repairing and rebuilding the Tower of Babel. His efforts were prematurely ended by his death at the young age of 32 or 33. After his death, his kingdom was divided among four of his generals, and the city of Babylon was seized by Seleucus in 312 BC. While Seleucus founded another city to serve as his capital, Babylon continued its existence as a religious center for several hundred years more. During the 2nd century BC, Josephus recorded that there were a large number of Jews still living in Babylon. The Greek historian Strabo, who lived from about 63 BC to AD 24, wrote that although most of the city of Babylon was deserted, there were religious groups living there known as Chaldeans who studied astronomy. While astronomy is a legitimate science, the fact that they were a religious group indicates that their study involved astrology as well, or perhaps astrology exclusively. The historian Pliny the Elder, who lived from AD 23 to 79, also wrote that the city was in major decline, but that it was still religiously significant. Dr. Dyer opines that it is likely that a Jewish community continued to exist in Babylon during the 1st century AD, and indeed that some of them may have been present at Pentecost, as it is described in Acts chapter 2. The Apostle Peter also mentioned Babylon in his first letter to the scattered believers. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13 says, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings." But scholars are divided on whether Peter's reference to Babylon meant the literal city on the Euphrates River, or whether it meant another small city with the same name in Egypt, or whether it was a coded reference to the city of Rome, or a coded reference to the city of Jerusalem. Dr. Dyer covers the few references to Babylon in the intervening 19 centuries, then notes that at the time that the German archaeologist Kaldewey began his excavations in the early 1900s, there were still a few small villages within the walls of the ancient city. When Saddam Hussein came to power in Iraq, he began the project of restoring and rebuilding the ancient city of Babylon. In September 1987, Iraq held its first annual Babylon Festival, ostensibly as a cultural as opposed to a political event. The official seal of the festival, however, placed the portraits of Saddam Hussein and Nebuchadnezzar side by side, and the portrait of Nebuchadnezzar looked eerily similar to that of Saddam Hussein. Clearly, the intent was to imply that Saddam Hussein was the successor of Nebuchadnezzar. There were two additional Babylon festivals, but the fourth one, scheduled for September of 1990, was canceled after Iraq invaded Kuwait and the first Gulf War began. Although the reconstruction project was not yet complete, what had been built was not damaged during that war. And with that brief overview of Babylon's history, let's turn to Revelation chapters 17 and 18 to see what else we can learn about Babylon. You will recall that chapter 16 describes the bowl judgments, and we covered those in week 6. When the seventh bowl is poured out, the wrath of God is finished. The day of the Lord is over. Once more, there are lightning, thunder, and a great earthquake, an unprecedented earthquake, described as such as there had not been since man came to be upon the earth, so great an earthquake was it, and so mighty. This earthquake splits the great city into three parts, and the cities of the nations fall. The question is, what city is this? Is it Jerusalem? Or is it Babylon? Since the remainder of this same verse 19 in chapter 16 says that Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath, it could be Babylon. On the other hand, the first part of this same verse 16 says, "The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell." Since the latter part of the sentence speaks of the cities of the nations, that seems to be contrasting all other cities with the holy city of Jerusalem. Remember that the Greek word that is translated into English as the nations is another way of saying Gentile or non-Jew. Another reason that it might be Jerusalem is that since the cities of the nations and Babylon are listed separately, this reference at the beginning of verse 19 to the great city might be a city that is different from the other two that are listed, that is, Babylon and the other cities of the nations. Because which city is intended by the great city is unclear, I checked the entirety of the text of the book of Revelation to see where else this phrase, the great city, appears. The first time it appears is in chapter 11, verse 8, which says that the dead bodies of the two witnesses, quote, "will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified." Clearly, this is a reference to Jerusalem. The other places in which the phrase "the great city" appears are in chapter 17, verse 18, and in chapter 18, in verses 10, 16, 18, 19, and 21. All the references to the great city in chapters 17 and 18 are to the city Babylon. But there is a further complicating question. Even if the great city is Babylon, does that mean the literal city of Babylon on the Euphrates, or is it a name that symbolizes some other city which has the characteristics of Babylon, in particular, spiritual harlotry or idolatry? One clue we are given comes from Revelation chapter 18, verses 17 and 18, which indicate that this city is a port city. In that case, it really is unlikely that the literal ancient Babylon, located in modern-day Iraq, is meant, because it is about 550 miles from the Persian Gulf. This map shows Iraq in the context of the surrounding nations, with the approximate location of the ancient Babylon marked with the arrow. While it is true that the city is near the Euphrates River, that river could not accommodate large ships, nor could it handle the volume of business that would justify verse 19 of chapter 18 saying that all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth. Despite these difficulties, however, we cannot discount the fact that the Euphrates River is named twice in the book of Revelation, at the sixth trumpet in chapter 9, and at the sixth bowl in chapter 16. If the literal ancient city of Babylon is not what is meant by the text of Revelation chapters 17 and 18, then the next most common nominee is Jerusalem. Since we know that the Antichrist will set himself up as God in the temple in Jerusalem, it seems logical that he would establish Jerusalem as his headquarters. The fact that the city of Jerusalem is 34 miles inland does not rule it out as a candidate, because in today's world, that's not such a great distance. And furthermore, if the entire city were on fire, I think the smoke would be visible to ships on the Mediterranean Sea. But there are other candidates that commentators have nominated. The most common one over the last several decades has been the city of Rome. This city is on the Tiber River, which is also too small for large ships, but the city is only approximately 15 miles inland. Again, not such a great distance. The nomination of Rome is based primarily on the belief that the Antichrist will be of Roman origin And that being Roman means being literally Italian, thus European, which is a misconception we dealt with last week when we discussed the possible countries of origin of the Antichrist. The Roman Empire covered all the territory surrounding the Mediterranean Sea. The Antichrist may be European, but he could just as easily be from one of the countries in the Middle East. Rome has also been considered as a candidate because there have been those in the past who think that the harlot represents the Catholic Church, primarily because of the colors scarlet and purple. I have not heard that particular possibility advanced for some years now. More recently, some have suggested that Babylon represents New York City. At least for the time being, it is the undisputed economic capital of the world, and it is a huge port city surrounded by water. These same verses 17 and 18 of Revelation 18 say that the shipmasters and passengers and sailors, and as many as make their living by the sea, watched at a distance the smoke of her burning. When the twin towers of the World Trade Center came crashing down on September 11, 2001, the smoke that rose into the sky could be seen not only from any ships at sea, but also from satellite images in outer space. Of course, Revelation chapter 18 is describing an event that is yet future. Personally, I am inclined to discount New York City as a possible choice for Babylon because I don't think that America will play any significant role in the end times events. I think the Middle East will be center stage, and that Babylon, whether it represents Jerusalem or some other city, will be somewhere in the Middle East. Now let's return to chapter 16 and take a quick look at the last verses there. Verse 17 tells us that the seventh bowl judgment has been poured out, and then the end of the day of the Lord is announced. Verse 18 states that a terrible earthquake occurs, unprecedented in its magnitude. Verse 19 says that the earthquake splits into three parts, whatever city the great city is. And then verse 20 tells us that every island flees away and the mountains are not found. That's almost the same language that is found in chapter 6, the latter part of verse 14, at the time of the breaking of the sixth seal, when there are cataclysmic events both in heaven and on earth. Of course, there is a difference. Here in chapter 16, the cataclysmic events are limited to the earth, whereas in chapter 6, there are upheavals in the heavens as well. In addition, at the earthquake here at the seventh bowl, chapter 16, we are told in verse 21 that huge hailstones rain down from heaven at that, yet again, men blaspheme God. The fall of Babylon is described in greater detail in chapters 17 and 18. We have already looked at chapter 17 in connection with the beast, but now let's focus on this woman who rides the beast. The title for chapter 17 might be The Judgment of the Harlot Named Babylon, the Woman Who Sits on the Scarlet Beast. It is curious that when the EU, the European Union, was formed, it chose as its symbol a woman riding a beast, depicted sometimes as a bull and other times as a more nondescript beast. People have speculated about the significance of this symbol. What I wonder is whether those who designed it had any knowledge of Revelation chapter 17 at all, a subject to which we will return now. You will recall that this scarlet beast has seven heads and ten horns. The seven heads represent seven mountains or kingdoms on which the woman sits, but they also represent seven kings. Strangely enough, the beast itself is an eighth king, and he, or it, is one of the seven. The ten horns of the beast represent the ten kings of the Eighth Empire. The woman who sits on this scarlet beast, that's verse 3 of chapter 17, is also described as the woman who sits on the seven mountains. That's verse 9. Thus, the seven mountains, as well as the seven heads of the beast, represent past kings and kingdoms, and they are all kings and kingdoms on whose backs this woman has sat. The name on her forehead is a mystery. It is called Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. What is the significance of this woman who is being described as a harlot in verses 1, 15, and 16 of chapter 17, and in verse 2 of chapter 19, and as the mother of harlots in verse 5 of chapter 17? The woman is called a harlot because she is in contrast to the true bride, who is composed of the faithful remnant of Israel and of the church. Harlotry represents spiritual unfaithfulness to God. How is one unfaithful to God? By worshiping false gods and by turning away from God. Particularly in the Old Testament, Israel was pictured as the wife chosen by God. But when the Israelites were unfaithful to God and went after false gods, then their spiritual unfaithfulness was compared to harlotry. Although there are many examples throughout the Old Testament, here are a few. Isaiah chapter 1 verse 21 says, "How the faithful city has become a harlot, she who was full of justice." Jeremiah chapter 3 verses 6 through 8, verse 6 says, "The Lord said to me, 'Have you seen what faithless Israel did? She went up on every high hill and under every green tree, and she was a harlot there.'" And verse 8 says, "And I saw that for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I had sent her away and given her a writ of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but she went and was a harlot also." Hosea chapter 4 verse 12 says, "My people consult their wooden idol, and their diviner's wand informs them, for a spirit of harlotry has led them astray, and they have played the harlot, departing from their God." Other examples are the Proverbs, in which the fool is seduced by the adulteress whose lips drip honey and has speech smoother than oil. That's Proverbs 5, 3. Proverbs 6, verses 24 to 26, exhort the reader to observe the commandments of God, because those commandments will keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. We are not to, quote, "desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her catch you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life." Just as a harlot seduces a man away from being faithful to his wife, so this harlot seduces all the people of the world away from the worship of the true God. By whatever means necessary, whether it is to deny the truth, or pervert the truth, or embellish the truth, she invades and pervades all levels of society and all cultures and all time periods of world history. Verse 1 of Revelation 17 tells us that she sits on many waters. The explanation of that phrase, "on many waters," is given in verse 15, which states that the waters where the harlot sits represent peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. This harlot is an equal opportunity seductress who is extremely skilled at her work. She seduces kings and commoners, men and women, slave and free, Jew and Gentile. Chapter 18, verse 23 says, "All the nations were deceived by her sorcery," a word which is also used in chapter 9, verse 21, and which refers to occult practices. The Greek word for sorcery is pharmakia. We get the word pharmacy from it. It means medication and by extension magic, either literally or figuratively, sorcery or witchcraft. The word pharmakia derives from other words that mean a drug or a spell-giving potion or a druggist, poisoner, or magician. Thus, most commentators opine that this harlot who sits on the beast and also on the waters represents all false religion and has her origin in the Satan-inspired rebellion of Nimrod and his Tower of Babel. It is a religious system which lures men away from the true God, and thus the harlot could represent any false religious system, or it could represent the apostate church, or apostate Judaism, or the final one-world religion. Of course, these possibilities are not mutually exclusive. Her unqualified success over the course of history stems from the fact that she rides the beast. They work together so that each may accomplish his or her own goals. This idolatry, this false religion, this harlotry, as God characterizes it, has been carried by, supported by, the seven kings and kingdoms represented throughout history by the seven mountains and the seven heads of the beast. Although we have already touched on it, let's look at verse 2 of Revelation 17 to learn more about this harlot. Verse 2 tells us that the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality with her. What this means is that, over the course of human history, various rulers, whether kings, dictators, or presidents, have led their countries away from God by cooperating with and participating in the false religious or idolatrous practices of the harlot. This would include judicial decisions, legislative acts, or executive edicts that by their very nature are acts of rebellion against God. The rest of verse 2 tells us that those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. Verse 6 tells us that even the woman herself was drunk, and now we learn the source of their intoxication. They get their drunken euphoria, their high, by killing Christians. This fact is confirmed in chapter 18, verse 24, which says that in her, that is, in Babylon, the great city, was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all those who have been slain on the earth. Verse 4 of chapter 17 describes the clothing of the harlot. She is clothed in purple and scarlet and is adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. Everything about her is lavish. She is meant to draw the attention of everyone. She is meant to be beautiful, attractive, and enticing. The fact that she is so lavishly attired indicates her enormous wealth, which she has accumulated over millennia of spectacular success. The color scarlet can represent royalty or luxury. In his lament over the deaths of Saul and Jonathan, King David said, "O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel." That's 2 Samuel 1:24. However, scarlet is also the color of sin. Most of us are familiar with this passage from Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18. "Though your sins are as scarlet, they will be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they will be like wool." Finally, scarlet is also the color of blood. And this is appropriate because the harlot is drunk with the blood of the saints. False religion is a murderer. It has killed and will kill untold millions of believers. And Satan, the red dragon, empowers the scarlet beast that carries the woman clothed in scarlet, who spills the red blood of the saints. Verse 4 of chapter 17 also tells us that she holds in her hand a gold cup. We have already seen from verse 2 that the cup is full of the wine of her immorality, and the kings of the earth and those who dwell on the earth are drunk with this intoxicating wine. Verse 4 of chapter 17 says that the harlot has in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. Once more, I am reminded of Proverbs, this time chapter 23, which speaks of the dangers of drunkenness. Not drinking, but drunkenness. Proverbs chapter 23, verses 31 to 33. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things. The wine in the gold cup of the harlot represents the appeal of false religion to the senses and to the sensual. The red wine sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. The reality, however, is that the cup is full of abominations and of the unclean things of the harlot's immorality. This is like the whitewashed sepulchers that Jesus compared the Pharisees to in Matthew chapter 23, verse 27. Externally, they looked very pious and very righteous, but internally they were rotten to the core. Similarly, these false religions are all about the externals, but the heart remains corrupt and fallen, and the soul remains lost. Contrast the cup of the harlot, described in Revelation chapter 17, verse 4, which entices fallen souls into unfaithfulness to God with her abominations and immorality, with God's cup. We are told in chapter 16, verse 19, that his cup contains the wine of his fierce wrath. The irony is that chapter 18, verse 6 tells us that in her cup, in which she mixed her intoxicating potions, twice as much of God's wrath will be mixed for her. For all those who are deceived by her sorceries, chapter 14, verse 10 tells us that they will, quote, drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. Close quote. Verse 5 of chapter 17 tells us that a name was written on the forehead of the harlot. This is not the first time that we have seen a mark on the forehead. In chapter 7, verse 3, we saw that the 144,000 Jews were given the seal of God on their foreheads, which was a sign of his ownership and protection. The 144,000 Jews belong to him. In chapter 13, verse 16, all the followers of the beast, that is, the Antichrist, are required to take a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. While there is no protection afforded those who take this mark, there is no question that they belong to him thereafter. Further, while we have not yet studied chapter 22, verse 4 of that chapter says that the bondservants of Christ will have his name on their foreheads. This harlot of chapter 17 also has an identifying mark on her forehead. We are told that it is a name, which is a mystery, and that the name is Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Let's deal first with the mystery. Verse 5 tells us that the name on her forehead is a mystery. Then verse 7 tells us that the angel is about to explain to John the mystery of the woman and of the beast who carries her. Remember, a mystery in the Bible is something that was in the eternal plan of God, but which, according to Romans chapter 16, verses 25 and 26, has been kept secret for long ages past, but now is manifested. In this case, the mystery which is revealed to John is in verse 18, that the woman, the harlot, is the great city which has dominion over the kings of the earth. In other words, the original Babylon, where Nimrod began the construction of the Tower of Babel, was the source of all false religion throughout the history of mankind. For that reason, the ancient city is the mother of all harlotry, meaning spiritual rebellion against God, and the mother of all abominations of a world governed by Satan. Thus, Babylon is the mother in the sense that it, or she, is the source or the beginning of this form of spiritual rebellion against God. All of the beast empires represented by the seven heads descended from the political and religious unity of Babel and were strongholds of polytheistic idolatry. Just as the harlot was carried by, supported by, the beast kingdoms, false religion is most effective when it is tied to the political government of an empire or a nation. Governmental sponsorship lends credibility and power to a false religion, and the religious authorities can in turn effectively promote all national activity against God. You may recall from our discussion about the Antichrist last week that the seven heads of this beast of Revelation 17 represent satanically driven kingdoms with this one thing in common. They ruled over and, to a greater or lesser extent, persecuted the Jews. In some cases, they attempted to annihilate all the Jews. And the reason for their hatred of the Jews goes back to Revelation chapter 12. The Messiah would come out of the Jews. Satan did all that he could to annihilate the Jews so that no Messiah could come from them. And then, when he failed to accomplish that goal, he changed his goal to annihilate all Jews and Christians so that the Messiah will have no subjects to populate his kingdom. The eighth king will be the Antichrist, and his kingdom will extend over the whole world. He will come closer to accomplishing the goal of Nimrod and his followers than any of his predecessors, and that goal is the establishment of a one-world government, a one-world economy, and a one-world religion. But the expression, mother of harlots, might also have another meaning besides being the source or the beginning of spiritual rebellion against God. Do any of you remember in about 2003, so that's been 10 years ago, at the beginning of the American war in Iraq, hearing the expression, the mother of whatever, the mother of all battles, the mother of all wars? It is an Eastern expression that indicates the superlative, the biggest, the worst, the most significant of all. The final Babylon will be the mother of harlots in the sense that it will be the largest, most widespread, and worst rebellion against God. The Antichrist, the eighth king of the final eighth empire, will complete what Nimrod began. Metaphorically shaking his fist in the face of God, he will establish a one-world government, one world religion, and one world economy. The center of it all will be a city which is called Babylon, but which may or may not be the literal ancient city near the Euphrates River. That city will have dominion over the kings of the earth, and that is the mystery which was revealed to John. Nevertheless, while we are considering Babylon, we must distinguish in our minds between one, the ancient city where all false religion began, and two, the worldwide false religious system that will be instituted in the last of the end days. It is the latter, the false religious system that will encompass the entire world. The name Babylon refers to both that false religious system as well as to whichever city serves as its headquarters. That the woman, the harlot, represents both the one world religious system as well as the city of its headquarters is confirmed in chapter 18. Verse 10 of that chapter describes Babylon as a great city and a strong city. Verse 16 of chapter 18 describes the city the same way that we saw the woman of chapter 17 described, as one clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. Returning to Revelation chapter 17, let's review what we have learned in the last couple of weeks about this confusing heads and horns business. Like the dragon of chapter 12 and the first beast that comes out of the sea in chapter 13, this beast of chapter 17 has seven heads and ten horns. Now let's begin with verse 9 of chapter 17. Verse 9 says, "The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits," verse 10, "and they are seven kings." So this means the seven heads represent seven kingdoms, that's the mountains, and seven kings. Verse 10 continues, "Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while." Verse 11, "And the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction." Although the seventh and eighth king and kingdom were future from John's perspective in the first century, from our perspective in the 21st century, only the eighth king and kingdom are still in the future, even though we cannot identify with certainty the seventh king and kingdom. But we have established that the seven heads represent past kings and kingdoms, and the ten horns, along with a little horn, represent a future king and kingdom. So, heads, past seven kings and kingdoms. Horns, future eighth king and kingdom. And somehow the beast itself is also part of that eighth king and kingdom. But here's the confusing part. The horns, which along with the beast itself are the future eighth king and kingdom, will also be one of the seven heads. That is one of the past seven kings or kingdoms. That's from Revelation 17 verse 11, which says, "And the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven." Let's go on to verse 12 of chapter 17, which says, "And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour." Since history has not recorded any one kingdom made up of ten kings, this means that this eighth king and kingdom are still in the future. These ten kings have not yet, as verse 12 says, received authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. When they do, then verse 13 says they have one purpose and they give their power and authority to the beast. Then verse 14 says that they, that is the ten horns, the ten kings, along with the beast to which they are attached, will wage war against the lamb. Moreover, verse 16 says that the ten horns and the beast to which they are attached will hate the harlot, and they will make her desolate and naked, and will eat her flesh, and will burn her up with fire. Directly after verse 16 describes the destruction of Babylon by the ten kings and the beast, the next verse, verse 17 of chapter 17, says, "God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose." Because Revelation 17 focuses on the spiritual harlotry of Babylon, it concerns the false religious system represented by the harlot and destroyed by the beast and the ten horns at the end of chapter 17. In contrast, chapter 18 describes in detail the fall of the city known as Babylon, and its destruction is by God himself. Chapter 18 begins with yet another angel coming down out of heaven, and his glory illuminates the earth. Remember that the fifth bowl judgment in chapter 16, verse 10, darkened the beast kingdoms. If it's worldwide, and it will be, that means the whole earth is in darkness. Both the light provided by the angel's glory and his mighty voice would attract the attention of the whole world. Having come down from heaven, this angel has authority that is great indeed. Speaking on behalf of God, the angel announces the fall of Babylon. In fact, the chapter title for chapter 18 might be The Fall of Babylon in 1 Hour. Verse 2 of chapter 18 provides additional information about the nature of this city, which is called Great and Strong. The latter part of this verse says that she, Babylon, has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. This is a very dark place indeed. Verse 3 of chapter 18 repeats what verse 2 of chapter 17 has told us, that the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And then this verse in chapter 18 adds that the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Verse 21 of chapter 18 also describes a strong angel, and it is unclear whether this is the same as the authoritative angel of verse 1. This angel takes up a stone like a great millstone and throws it into the sea and announces the manner of Babylon's destruction. The punishment will be doubly horrific because verse 6 of chapter 18 tells us that another voice from heaven says, quote, "Give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her." Verse 5 of chapter 18 has told us that her sins have piled up as high as heaven. What Nimrod failed to do with the Tower of Babel, the Antichrist and his kingdom will accomplish. He and it will reach heaven, albeit with sin. The sudden destruction of the city is described in verses 10, 17, and 19 as occurring in 1 hour, and in verse 8 as in 1 day. The swiftness of its fall is consistent with the character of the bowl judgments because they will be rapidly delivered in a short amount of time. Chapter 16, verses 17 through 21 indicate that this judgment of Babylon is connected with the seventh bowl. It is interesting to note that the swift fall of Babylon, which is described in Revelation chapter 18, is not without precedent. Those of you who studied Daniel may remember that in chapter 5, the handwriting appeared on the wall, and that very night, the Babylonians were conquered by the Medes and the Persians. Verse 24 of chapter 18 says that the city is being judged because in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all who will have been slain on the earth. This is confirmation that God has finally avenged not only the blood of the martyrs, as was promised at the time of the fifth seal, but also the blood of all of God's prophets and saints who were slain on the earth over the course of history. The martyrs slash witnesses have at last been vindicated. Justice has been done. There are earlier references to this purpose of God's judgment of Babylon in other verses as well. For example, in chapter 17, verse 6 tells us that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And in chapter 18, verse 20, the voice from heaven instructs the inhabitants of heaven and the saints and the apostles and prophets to rejoice because God has pronounced judgment against her on their behalf. God has had his day of vengeance. Another thing we learn from chapter 18 about this Babylon, whether it is the literal ancient Babylon or a metaphor for some other city, whatever city is the center of the Antichrist's one world religion, is that it will also be the center of a one world economy. It will be the equivalent of the New York City, the Wall Street of the world. How do we know this? Let's just work our way through some of the verses in chapter 18. Verse 3 says, "The merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." Beginning at verse 11, we are told that the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over the destruction of the city because no one will buy their cargoes anymore. Verse 14 tells us that all things that were luxurious and splendid were found in that city. Verse 15 tells us that once more, the merchants of these things listed in verses 12 through 15 became rich from her. Verse 17 tells us that in 1 hour, such great wealth was laid waste. The same verse 17 and verse 19 say, "Every shipmaster and passenger and sailor and as many as made their living by the sea wept and mourned, as well as all who had ships at sea and had become rich by her wealth." Verse 22 speaks of musicians and craftsmen and the sound of the mill no longer being heard. Verse 23 says that the merchants of Babylon were the great men of the earth. And not only do the merchants and shippers weep and lament over the destruction of Babylon, but so do the kings of the earth. That's in verse 9. "Even today, business and government are so intertwined that what happens in one area cannot help but affect the other. How much more so will that be true when there is literally one world government and one world economy?" Please note, however, what else is said about the kings of the earth in verse 10 and the merchants in verse 15 and the passengers, shipmasters, and sailors of verse 17. All of them stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment. All of them are afraid to get too close, fearful that they may share in her destruction. Although this is the specific punishment of a particular city, there will be no escape from the wrath of God for those standing at a distance either. It is also interesting to note that while all these groups of people were weeping and mourning, they were not doing so out of sympathy for those within the city. They are upset only because of the impact the fall of this city will have on them and on their pocketbooks. Verse 11 says, "The merchants weep and mourn because no one buys their cargoes anymore, and because, according to verse 17, such great wealth has been laid waste." One final question about the events that are described in chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation is where to place the destruction of Babylon on the timeline of the 70th week of Daniel and thereafter. We know from chapter 16, verses 17 through 19, that the destruction of Babylon, as it is described in chapter 18, appears to be associated with the seventh bowl judgment. That means that God's destruction of the city must be at some point in the short time period after the end of the 70th week. The remaining question is, when is the harlot of chapter 17 destroyed by the ten horns and the beast? The reason why I don't think that this is part and parcel of the destruction of the city, as that is described in chapter 18, is that one of the hallmark characteristics of the day of the Lord is that God's wrath will be poured out directly through his angels. It will be unlike any prior time in human history when God used other humans or nations, even evil men, evil nations, to chasten or to discipline his people or to judge a nation whose cup of iniquity was deemed to be full. The fact that verses 16 and 17 of chapter 17 describe God using evil kings and an evil antichrist to destroy the Babylonian harlot indicates to me that this must occur before the onset of the day of the Lord. Remember that Babylon is a description or a representation of both a one-world religious system and a city that is the center of that false religion. Chapter 17 of Revelation focuses on the religious aspects of Babylon. In contrast, chapter 18 focuses more on the city itself, on the economic aspects of the city of Babylon. Nevertheless, in both chapters, they are both called Babylon and both mention the blood of the saints. In chapter 17, that's in verse 6, and in chapter 18, that's in verse 24. Since the name Babylon represents both the religious system and the economic and political center of the final world empire, one possible explanation is that the Babylon of Revelation 17, that is the religious system, is destroyed by the Antichrist himself and his 10 kings who have given their power and authority to him. For the first 3.5 years of the 70th week, most of the world, including most of Israel, will not know the true nature of the Antichrist. As he is consolidating his control over the entire world, most nations will cede their authority and sovereignty to him, wanting peace at any cost. At the midpoint of the 70th week, the Antichrist will commit the abomination of desolation. He will enter into the rebuilt temple at Jerusalem. He will put a stop to the grain offerings and sacrifices that will have been reinstituted. He will set himself up as God, and he will demand that the world worship him as God. Since 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4 says that the Antichrist will oppose and exalt himself above every so-called God or object of worship, this means he will not allow anyone in the world to worship anyone or anything except himself. That would include even the false religious system that has helped him to gain the power that he has. Whatever the religious system is, the Antichrist cannot allow it to continue if he himself is taking his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Nothing can interfere with the world's worship of the Antichrist himself. So, he and his 10 kings destroy this false religious system. He sets himself up as God, and his false prophet enforces the world's compulsory worship. The city of Babylon is thereafter no longer the center of the false religious system, except insofar as it has been subsumed into the worship of the Antichrist. Nevertheless, the city continues to flourish as the commercial and political center of the world until God destroys it in the seventh bowl judgment. Because we know that the seventh bowl judgment ends the day of the Lord and the wrath of God, the destruction of the city of Babylon can be placed on the timeline shortly after the end of the 70th week. Remember that the last trumpet judgment coincides with the end of the 70th week, and the bowl judgments are poured out swiftly thereafter. That's God's destruction of the city itself. The destruction of the religious system represented by the harlot, who is also called Babylon, would be placed at the middle of the 70th week. I am not adamant, however, about the timing of the destruction of the religious system for this reason. Both chapters 17 and 18 describe the destruction of Babylon as with fire. Chapter 17, verse 16 says that the 10 kings and the beast will burn the harlot up with fire. Chapter 18, verses 8, 9, and 18, and chapter 19, verse 3, describe the city itself being burned up with fire, and there are references to the smoke of her burning. The repetition of these references to both being burned up with fire and to smoke of her burning indicate that the destruction of both the religious system and of the city itself may occur at the same time. Nevertheless, what is clear is that the instrument of destruction in the case of the harlot, the religious system, is the Antichrist along with his ten kings. But in the case of the city itself, God himself destroys it. Our God is a God of perfect justice. Revelation 19 verse 2 says, His judgments are true and righteous. And verses 6 and 7 of chapter 18 say this, Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. Verse 7 says, To the degree that she has glorified herself, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. In his day of the Lord will right all wrongs, avenge the blood of every martyr, and punish those who persist in rebellion against him and his holiness. Make every effort to ensure that you are on the right side of the law while there is still time to choose. Before our final hymn, allow me to quote C.S. Lewis, who wrote the following in Mere Christianity. God is going to invade all right, but what is the good of saying you are on his side then, when you see the whole natural universe melting away like a dream, and something else, something it never entered your head to conceive, comes crashing in? Something so beautiful to some of us and so terrible to others that none of us will have any choice left. For this time it will be God without disguise. Something so overwhelming that it will strike either irresistible love or irresistible horror into every creature. It will be too late then to choose your side. There is no use saying you choose to lie down when it has become impossible to stand up. That will not be the time for choosing. It will be the time when we discover which side we really have chosen, whether we realized it before or not. Now, today, this moment is our chance to choose the right side. God is holding back to give us that chance. It will not last forever. We must take it or leave it. End quote. Our final hymn. The Son of God goes forth to war, a kingly crown to gain. His blood-red banner streams afar. Who follows in his train? Who best can drink his cup of woe, triumphant over pain? Who patient bears his cross below? He follows in his train. The martyr first, whose eagle eye could pierce beyond the grave, who saw his master in the sky and called on him to save. Like him, with pardon on his tongue in midst of mortal pain, he prayed for them that did the wrong. Who follows in his train? A glorious band, the chosen few on whom the Spirit came. 12 valiant saints, their hope they knew, and mocked the cross and flame. They met the tyrant's brandished steel, the lion's gory mane. They bowed their necks the death to feel. Who follows in their train? A noble army, men and boys, the matron and the maid, around the Savior's throne rejoice in robes of light arrayed. They climbed the steep ascent of heaven through peril, toil, and pain. O God, to us may grace be given to follow in their train. Amen.